Okay, we're going to start here with the Mishnah on Kof Aleph Amud Aleph. The Mishnah begins, Chayavei Arachin, Mimashkanin Otan. When it comes to Arachin, person that made the Neder Arachin and now owes the money to the treasury of the Mikdash, Mimashkanin Otan, we take collateral from them in order to ensure that they will pay the Arachin. Since there is nothing that is compelling them to pay it, we ensure that they pay it by taking collateral. On the other hand, Chayavei Chataot V'Ashamot, Ein Mimashkanin Otan. Person's obligated to bring a Chatat or an Asham. There we do not take collateral from them in order to ensure that they bring the korban. The reason for that is because a person will be compelled to bring the chatat and sham in order to attain kapara. They have self-motivation to bring such a korban. They don't need any outside stimuli to ensure that they bring the korban. On the other hand, chayavei olot ushlamim mimashkanin otam. When it comes to olah and shlamim, and olam and shlamim, which are a neder or nidava, for sure, a person doesn't feel compelled to bring them because they are voluntary offerings. But here we're talking about even olot or shlamim that are obligatory offerings. Nevertheless, mimashkanin otam, because those are korbanot that a person does not feel compelled to bring. And as Rashi points out, even though an olah is mechaper nasei, it's not something that is so compelling to the individual that they would bring it. Now, first can only bring a korban willingly. If he doesn't bring it willingly, it's not classified as a good korban. Shenemar, because the pasuk says lirtzono. He has to bring it lirtzono. Nevertheless, kofinoto ad shemar rotzeani. We whip him until he says yes, that I want to bring it. I'm ready to bring it. Same thing by a get with a woman. A get must be given willingly. Person must give a get out of their own free will. And if the person is refusing to give the get, we can force them through the bait in by kofinoto. We whip him until he says, yes, I do want to give it. Now, what type of rotzeani is this? Of course, if you whip him until he says rotzeani, he's going to say rotzeani. So this brings up the very famous Rambam. The Rambam in Hilchud Gerushin, Perek Bet, Halacha Chaf, brings up, asks this question about how does it work that when you apply force, the person says, Rotzeani, and then we say, oh yeah, he really wanted to do it. So Rambam says, when it comes to an individual, people, their nature is to want to do right, and their underlying Kedusha in them will want them to, make them want to do right. The only thing is that there are chataim, there are certain outside variables, exogenous variables, that cause the person not to want to do this proper thing. So when we whip them, we remove those exogenous variables, and we get the person back to their core goodness, where they're going to say yes, because that's what's compelling. So therefore, when we say rotzeoni, in the end, the Rambam says, we're going to bring the person back to where they really want to be. And so we're just helping them to get to the right decision. But because of that, the Rambam says very particularly that it's only if you do it midin. It's only if you are entitled or you have the right to whip them, does this work. Because over there, you can say that the Beit Din acted to bring him to the point where he should have been. But if they do it shalokid din, where they didn't have a right to do it, and they don't have that option, and they do it anyway, then we do not say that they brought him to the point where he wanted to be anyway rotzeani, because Beit Din, first of all, didn't have the right, and number two, is if Shainu Kedin, he wasn't compelled to do that. He's not compelled to do it. We can't compel him to do it. So that's our understanding of the Mishnah. So Amar Papa. Papa says that the principles laid out in the Mishnah are not definitive principles, because Pe'amim Shechayevei Chata'ot Mimashkinim Otam. There's sometimes where a Chatat, we will take a Mashkon, we will take collateral to compel the person to bring it, and sometimes chayvei olot ain mimashkinim otam. Sometimes there are olot that we do not have to take collateral for. Chayvei chataot mimashkinim otan. When do you have to take a mashkon when it comes to a chatat? That's when we're talking about the chatat anazir. The nazir brings 3 korbanot on the completion of his nazirut. He brings a chatat, he brings an olah, and he brings a shlamim. So we know that the nazir, in a sense, was not choteh, and therefore when he brings the chatat at the end, it's not a chatat from a sense of kapara. Number 2 is, what does the nazir want? He wants to permit himself to now drink wine, to be mitameh lemetim. So does he need the chatat to do that? The answer is no. That's what the Gemara says. The chatat nazir, the kevan, the amar mar im gileach alechad mishloshtam. If he does the giluach, the shaving of his head, on any one of the 3 karbanot, means the olah, the chatat, or the shlamim, yatzah. And if one of the korbanot is brought and the dam was brought on mizbeach, then he's allowed to drink wine and to be mitameh lemetim. So the termination of his period of nizirut is only dependent on one korban. So if he brought the Olah or the Shlamim already, the Chatat, he does not feel compelled to bring. And therefore, we will be Mashkanin Oto. We will take collateral from him in order to compel him to bring the Chatat, even though he doesn't feel so compelled to bring it. That's what the Gemara says, Pasha Bavlo Maite. Since he will be negligent in bringing it, then we step in to help him out. Chai Ve'olot. When it comes to Olot, Eim Mashkanin Otan. Where is the case where you don't have to take a Mashkon? Bolat, Yoledet. Yoledet brings a Chatat and an Olah. In that case, we say that Olah, we don't have to take a Mashkon for. So mind you, why is it that we don't have to bring it? Because the Mishnah says, Da'akdamekra, because it's written first in the Pasuk. Over there it says, you first bring the Olah, then the Chatat. So I would think that the woman needs the Chatat, but the Olah is a gift. But because the Torah places it in such an order that you have to bring the Olah first and then the Chatat, she'll be compelled to bring the Olah. V'hamarobah the Mikra'ah hikdima katuv. That's only in the Pasuk that they go first. But in reality, the Chatat is brought before the Olah. And if the woman already brings the Chatat, and then she is Nitar, the Kanes, the Mikdash, and to eat Kodesh, and she already had her Kapara, whatever that means in terms of the Chatat over here, then she doesn't feel compelled to bring the Olah. And therefore, we would take a Mashkon. So that can't be the exception to the rule. Ela Bolat Mitzora. Exception to the rule is the Olah of the Mitzora. Detanya, Rabbi Shmuel ben Osher, Rabbi Yehuda ben Brokomer, Shem Shechatato, Ve'ashamo Ikavto, Kach olotok ikavto. When it comes to the mitzorah, at the end of his period of mitzorah, on the eighth day after his tahara, on that day he brings three karbanot, he brings a chatat, an asham, and an olah. But since we have this member from Mishmael ben Osher, Rabbi Yehuda ben Broka, that a mitzorah requires all three karbanot in order to relieve himself of the tumata mitzorah, therefore he feel compelled to bring the olah. We won't have to encourage him to bring it because he has a reason on his own to bring it, which is that he wants to become tahor. So in that case, we won't take a mashkon for an olah. So this is Rapapa's statement, which is that the Mishnah's definition of what we do take collateral from, what we don't take collateral from, is not necessarily divided along the lines of olah and chatat, but rather divided along the lines of what is the purpose of that olah, what's the purpose of that chatat. If the olah or chatat is absolutely necessary for that person to attain kapara or tehara, then we won't take a mashkon because they have something that will compel them to bring it. On the other hand, if it's a chatat or an olah that isn't necessary to accomplish kapara or tehara, or to be matin them in anything, then we'll say that we'll take a mashkon in both of those, both the chatat and the olah, in order to ensure that the person is sufficiently compelled to bring the korban. We're going to bring him, meaning not just the korban, but we're going to force him to bring it. We would think that you could force him against his will. As to do it willingly. How could you force him, but you need him to be willing? That's what the Mishnah said, that we whip him until he says, I will do it. And that's what we explained in the Mishnah, according to the Rambam, that Rotzani is something that is voluntary in the end and not being compelled because that's what the person really wants to do. I'm a Shmuel. Olah tzricha dat. Shmuel says that an Olah requires one to have knowledge about it. Shinemar, lirtzono. Because it says lirtzono, which means that it has to be of his own will and volition. It's my kamashvalon. Kanino. We have our Mishnah. Alpha pish she'ein mitkaper lo achit retzeh. Shinemar, lirtzono. So what do you mean? Our Mishnah says that. That even though it's not Milchaper Achid Ratzeb, because it says Liritzono. So you see from our Mishnah that it must be Liritzono or Lidato in order to bring the Korban Olah. Where it says, look, Tzricha, the Parish Le Chavre, his friend took out an Olah on his behalf. He's Chayav an Olah, and his friend then separates out and says, this Olah will be for you. So Ma'adebe Teima Kibin and Dat Midide. The only time we need dat is when he's mafrish for himself. Abba min dechabrei, lo. But when it comes to his friend, we won't require dat. Mashmalan, zimlan delo nechle, dechaper midei delo didei. Sometimes a person feels that he does not want to gain or attain kapara through someone else's expenditure. A person might feel that they want to spend on their own, they want to pay for it on their own in order to attain the kapara. And therefore, we don't automatically assume it's a zechut lo, and the korban is his, we need his dat. We need him to know about, or his knowledge about the korban in order for it to be his korban. So that is, if it's his, obviously he will do it that way. But even if a friend does it on his behalf, you need to notify him that you've separated out the korban on his behalf. Person says, I'm going to bring the chatat or the asham of so-and-so. Ledat yatsa. If he did it willingly, then yes, he's yotzei. Shalom ledat lo yatsa. But if he didn't know about it, he didn't have knowledge of it, then he's not Yotze. So here the Braita suggests that there's a differentiation between Chatat and Hashem, Kapara, and Ola and Shlamim. By Chatat Hashem, where you're trying to attain Kapara, and the person needs to know about it in order to attain the Kapara, there we require Dat. On the other hand, when it comes to the Ola Shlamim, there, we're not going to require that. Even Shalomi that, it will work. So I'm going to call Shmuel. So what's Shmuel going to do with this Braita? This Braita sounds like Ola does not have the requirement of that. So Shmuel says, you're talking about two different distinct periods of time. Kitanyo, that Braita is speaking about Bishat Kapara. The time that he is gaining Kapara. At the time that he brings the Korban to be Mukrav in the Mizbeach. Dirtze, Bishat Hafratza. And when did I talk about the Ratzon? Is at the time of Hafrashah, when he's taking out the Korban, when he's separating out the Korban. There's a point in time when you designate the Korban, and there's a point in time when you actually bring the Korban. Shmuel says, I'm making my statement at the point of Hafrashah, De'irtze b'shat Hafrashah, that he already had acceptance, acquiescence to this Korban at the time when he separated out the Korban. The Braita is speaking about Shat Kapara. At Shat Kapara, once we reach the point where you're putting it on the Mizbeach, then, by Chatat Vasham, we're going to need you to be aware and be a participant, because we need to do smicha on the animal. And that smicha is a vidui on the chait that you're bringing the Chatat for. You need to be involved in the process, therefore we're going to demand that it be ledat. On the other hand, by Ola Ushlamim, Ola Ushlamim are voluntary offerings. They, even though they might require smicha, they might not require as much knowledge or connection with the Korban, because they're not brought on a specific event or a specific chait. But by the side of Hafrashah, when it comes to separating out the animals, Shmuel says that everyone has got to have dat. Doesn't matter Ola Shlamim, doesn't matter Chatat or Sham, but that goes back to what we said before, that a person might want to use his own money to bring the Korban. You can't impose on your friend to take your Korban that you separated on his behalf if he'd rather bring his own Korban with his own money. So Shmuel says, I'm speaking about Hafrashah. The Braita is speaking about Shat Kapara. I'm speaking about Hafrashah where we're not sure if a person really wants to take from others in that point, so therefore we need knowledge of every Korban. The Braita is speaking about Kapara, which there, Kapara is dependent on Smicha, and that will be focused on the Chatat and the Hashem, not on the Ola and the Shlamim. On the other hand, we have the opinion of Ula, Upliga de Ula. Shmuel's position argues on Ula, Dama Ula. Lo chilku ben Chatat de Ula, el Shchatat Tzricha Dat, v'shat Hafrashah, v'Ola ain't Tzricha Dat, v'shat Hafrashah. So here it's explicit. Ula says that there is no differentiation between a Chatat and Ola, except that a Chatat requires Dat at the time of Ashra, Hafrashah. The Ola ain't Tzricha Dat, v'shat Hafrashah. Aval b'shat Kapara, idi v'idi ledat yatzah, shlo ledat lo yatzah. So first of all, Ula says, when it comes to the Shat Kapara, you for certain need dat on any korban that you're bringing, because you're going to do smicha on that korban. We want you to be attached and aware of the korban that you're bringing. And anytime you have smicha, it's going to require dat. So that's true. Shlamim, Ola, Chatat, Hashem, everything you're going to have dat for at the Shat Kapara. So that obviously argues in Shmuel. Shmuel says you don't need dat for an Ola Shlamim there. You might need it for Chatat Hashem, but not for an Ola Shlamim. The other side, it's Tzad HaFrashah. Tzad HaFrashah, he says only a Chatat and Hashem require dat b'Shat HaFrashah. Ola Shlamim do not require dat. Again, Shmuel says that an Ola does require dat even at the time of HaFrashah. So Meitebe, you're going to ask on Ula's position. Chatato v'ashamo alato shlamav shel ploni alai ledat yatza shlo ledat lo yatza. So what are you going to do with this Braita? It says, Chatat Hashem Ola Shlamim, you have to bring in ledat, shlo ledat doesn't work. So Shmuel mugila b'shat HaFrashah. Shmuel says, that's not about the time when you separate out the Korban, because that's when I say I require dat for any Korban that you separate. Ula mukila b'shat kapara. Ula said that when it comes to kapara, you need the dat for everyone. Doesn't matter Ola Shlamim, Chatat, Hashem, they all need dat. Samra papa matnaita hadade lokashin. What about the fact that we have a stira between the Braitot? We have a Braita here that says, ledat yatzah shlo ledat lo yatzah. And then we have the Braita above, which says, ledat yatzah shlo ledat lo yatzah by Chatat and Hashem, I agree, but Ola Shlamim, they said, ben ledat, ben shalom ledat. So how are you going to reconcile an Ola Shlamim between the first Braita that we brought and this second Braita that we brought? So he says, that's not a problem. Ha, b'shat kapara. Ha, b'shat hafrashah. That one of the Braitot we were speaking about, this man kapara, and one of the Braitot we were speaking about, shat hafrashah. Now, depending if you're Shmuel or Ula, you'll explain one of the Braitot one way and the other one the other way. Meaning, for Shmuel, Shmuel who says that by hafrashah you need everything to be al dat abalim, Therefore, he'll say that this second Braita that we brought down, that it puts all the Karbanot together, that Braita is speaking about Shat Hafrasha. The Braita above, as Shmuel already told us, is speaking about Shat Kapara. Shat Kapara, only Chatan Hasham matter. Ulai Shlamim don't matter. Ula will do it the other way around. Ula will say, Shat Kapara, everything has to be brought at Shat Kapara, it has to be Ladat. Therefore, this Braita, the second Braita I brought down, that was speaking about Shat Kapara. But a Shat HaFrasha, that will go with the first Braita. Shat HaFrasha, Chatat Hashem do require it. Ula and Shlamim do not require it. Again, the Shitatam, Ula and Shmuel will be able to explain the Braitot, but we can reconcile between the two Braitot by having them referencing different points in time, different cases. V'amurai, nami lo kashyo. Again, the Amoraim are not going to have a problem with these Braitot, just as we explained. Shmuel muki kamaita b'shat kapara. The first Braitot, like he did before, says it's b'shat kapara. But right to the second one that we brought, b'shat hafrasha, as we just explained. Ula mupagi ipcha, and Ula would do just the opposite. Where it says, Amorai vaday plige. The Amoraim have to definitely be arguing. Where it says, pshita, of course. It's pretty clear that they're arguing. They have opposite opinions. Where it says, now, maldutayim amai b'shat hafrasha, the Kamar Shmuel. When Shmuel says that b'shat hafrasha, you need to have b'yad for the Ula, af b'shat hafrasha. That even at the time of hafrasha, you will have to have dat, but that means that shat kapara, he would also agree that everything needs dat b'shat kapara, like Ula. Now, the truth is, and as Tosafot points out, Shmuel still can't agree with Ula. Because Ula believes by shat hafrasha that Ula Shlomim do not require dat. So when we say here that Shmuel is going to say that after hafrasha means that he means for both kapara and hafrasha, just the machloka that we thought before, which was on both sides, we'll only say that it's on one side now. Everybody will agree b'shat kapara that you need all of them to be the dat. B'shat hafrasha will be a machloka Shmuel and Ula, but that's different than what we're saying now. Until now we've been saying it's a machloka in both b'shat kapara and shat hafrasha. This way it would reconcile at least the Shat Kapara issue, the Shat HaFrasha will remain a makloket. That's what we mean over here. Even though if he has such an opinion, then the first Braita will be a problem from him, because the first Braita differentiates between Ula and Chatat. And according to Shmuel, there's going to be no differentiation, not by HaFrasha, not by Kapara, based on this. So Kamash Malon, that's not what Shmuel said. Shmuel said HaFrasha and not Kapara, and therefore Shmuel and Ula argue on both points. They both argue on the point of Shat HaFrasha, where Shmuel says you need, everything needs dat there, and Ula says only Chatat Vasham need a dat, and they argue by Shat Kapara, where Shmuel says only Chatat Vasham require dat, whereas Ula will say that everything across the board requires dat by kapara. Right now we finish off the perek with the last line of Mishnah. V'chein begitei nashim. Same is true by a woman's get. Amar Rav Sheshet, hay man demaser moda gita, modei moda. Person gets two eidim together before he goes to give a get. He tells the eidim that I'm giving this get under duress. I really don't want to give it, but I'm giving it under duress. That moda, that which he told to the eidim, stands, and it can undermine the get that he's given. Pshito, of course that's the case. They pressured him, and then he acquiesced to give the get. So I would have thought, once he acquiesces to give the get, it's automatic. The default is that the moda'a goes away. That's not the case. That he has to actively remove the moda'a, otherwise it remains in place. Dim kain, litnei achiitain. Because if that was the case, it would say, until he gives the get. My achiomar. What does it mean until he says, until he is mevatel that which he had said before? And that's why it says, when he says, makinotad shemor rotze ani, so why does he have to just say yomar rotze ani? What do you mean he has to speak? It wouldn't be enough that you whip him until he gives the get? No. Ad shomar, yomar means that we need him to say that he retracts any other refusals that he had to give the get. He's retracting all of them at this point. Tosafot brings down, and therefore that's the minhag of the sofrim. The minhag of the sofrim is when a person comes before a sofer and asks him to write a get, hikach nagolam the vatel kol moda'ai, that they would be vato all the moda'ot, umoda'ai da'atumigo moda'ai b'shat ktivat haget, time they write the get, u'b'shat ha'netina, and again when he gives the get, t'chashina shema batel oto, because we're afraid that he might have nullified the get without us knowing. So therefore, we make it at the time of the writing of the get, as well as the time of the giving of the get, we say that all decks are cleared. You have to say that I have no other outstanding statements that will undermine my willingness to give this get. So that's how we prevent there being these modai that we don't know. We demand that the person say that I discharge or I relinquish all modai, and because of that, then we'll be able to get the get without any chashashot. Now this Gemara, connected with other Gemaras, leads us into a very important sugya, the sugya of get meuseh, a get that's given under coercion. For our Gemara, it seems that like a get can be given under coercion. The Gemara in Gittin, it's a Mishnah in Gittin, as well as Gemara there, the Mishnah in Gittin says that it's only true if Israel does the meuseh. If the Israel is the one who coerces the individual, then it works. If an Akum coerces the Israel, it does not work. Then the Gemara goes on to discuss over there, why is it? By Israel it works, by an Akum it doesn't work. There's also a Gemara in Baba Batra that talks about coercion in terms of selling a field. And over here the Gemara says that if one sells a field under duress, they say they're going to kill him unless he sells the field. Then we say that when he sells the field and accepts the money, or if he accepts a shtar, that we assume that he did sell the field. And that, he said Rotzani, basically, that I wanted to sell it. Because of the onse, because of the situation he is in, gamar makne, he's gomer and he gives it over. So what we have to do now is reconcile between all these gemarot. You have to deal with number one, which is, when is it considered to be proper coercion, like our gemara, and where is it considered to be improper coercion, like the gemara in Gittin says, as well as the gemara in Baba Batra, which describes a case by mecher that it's true, but not necessarily by gitei nashim. The second thing we have to discuss is, when is it okay to have a akum involved in the process? The Mishnah in Gittin concludes that if Yisrael is watching over the akum and directing the akum, then it works. So in terms of what is considered to be coercion, there's a Tshuvat HaRadvaz. The Tshuvat HaRadvaz says that any iyum, any fear, or any duress that the person is put under, that is considered to be duress, and the get is mi'useh, it's not a kosher get. He's put under duress for any reason. It doesn't necessarily have to be physical duress. It can even be fear, psychological duress. It has to be something that leaves a person in a position where they can't willingly state their true opinion or their true feelings about this. That's number one. Number two is the Tashbetz brought down by the Beit Yosef wants to separate between money and gufo. That if coercion is done through bodily harm or physical or psychological duress, that would be problematic. But if the duress is created through monetary means, that would not be a problem. It's okay to create duress through monetary means. We're going to see later on that we qualify that statement. The Rabbeinu Tam, quoted in the Gittin, there's a Tosfot that quotes the Rabbeinu Tam, not fully. The Rosh quotes the Rabbeinu Tam more fully. It says that Rabbeinu Tam says we can apply pressure by doing all sorts of things, putting him in chirim, not doing business with him. Doing things that we refuse to do, without asking him to do anything, we refuse to do things with him, and that's fine. That's an external pressure that has nothing to do with the get. And the qualifying point is that as long as the individual can live in that situation and remain in that situation, that's not called duress. If a person is happy with everybody not doing business with him, nobody talking to him being a social outcast, then that's fine. If he doesn't want to then give a get because of that, he has that option. If he does give a get because that compels him, doesn't mean he was under duress, that means he was forced because he had the other option. And based on that, the qualifications that Pitkei Tshuva and others bring down on the qualification of the Tashbetz, that when it comes to money, it's only true where there's a real obligation for money. You can't take money. You can't take money away from the individual just to encourage them to give the get. Now the Pitkei Tshuva that brings down that it's pashut to him that if a woman steals money from her husband in order to trade to get her get, that it would work. But the Tashbetz and also the Tarat HaGdolah don't think that's true, and they're mistapek in that situation where it really works. Based on that, comes to the machloket between, it's a little bit of a machloket, although in the end they really have a very similar opinion. It's just a little more nuanced. The machloket between Rabbi Moshe Feinstein Zatzal and Rabbi Menashe Klein. They discuss over there what's called, or in other ways known as the get law. In many countries and in many states, the civil authorities put into effect laws that say that a woman can demand that she gets a get in order for the divorce proceedings to go through. That the person will only be freed, even in a secular sense, if she gets a get that is a proper get in halacha. So in that case, we have to discuss now the issue of an akum forcing a person to do this. People wrote to Rav Moshe asking him whether this was okay. One of the letters comes from Johannesburg. The way they wanted to do it there was a person would not be able to get a civil divorce unless they had a religious divorce. Moshe says that's fine. That's totally fine as long as that the demand of the religious divorce is before the civil divorce. If they cannot attain a civil divorce because they have yet to give a get, then that's not forced, that's not duress. The person has the option not to get a get. He has the option not to get divorced civilly. That's fine. So if he wants to get the right to be divorced civilly, he must jump through this hoop. That hoop is giving her a get. That is not considered to be a get to Musa. That's not considered to be that there's coercion al yidei akum or by the civil authorities. On the other hand, if they're allowed to get a civil divorce and then afterwards they can give the get, then it's problematic, he says, because the enforcement at that point is being done by a secular court, and the secular court is just enforcing that he must give the get. That we don't allow, that doesn't work. That's one way. The other tshuva, this is the biggest tshuva that Rav Moshe writes on this topic, is about a story or a case up in Portland, Oregon, that there were some chashashot that were raised many years later about a divorce that had taken place. A woman wanted to divorce her husband. She was being held captive by the husband. In the end, the court demanded that this husband pay a large sum of money, and they incarcerated him because he wasn't paying the money. The court agreed that if he gave a get to the woman, that she would forgive the money that he owed her, and they would let him free, they would set him free. So there was a writer, a questioner writing to Rav Moshe asking whether that was a get muser. This woman had remarried, had children, and they were mamzerim according to this. So Rav Moshe first says that it is inappropriate to raise the issue because it was done by a Rav who is a proper Rav, was an Orthodox Rav, and did what he thought was proper. To question the get many years later, he says, is improper. He says, even though I wouldn't question it, I want you to say that it's a good kosher get. And that is because woman is entitled to mizonot from her husband. And in a situation where the husband leaves the woman stuck, where she can't go out and get married, and she's stuck to him because he refuses to give her a get, he thinks that the husband has an obligation to pay mizonot to the woman. And therefore, if the secular court says that he owes her money, and that money can reasonably be assumed to be what he would owe her for the mizonot, then the secular court is not doing anything that is not already there. There's already an obligation for mizonot. They're just enforcing that obligation for mizonot. Then he has a choice now. He can either pay the money, or he can give the get. Now, he chose that he doesn't want to give up the money, therefore he gives the get. That's a personal choice that he's making. That's a personal choice that he feels more attached to his money than he does about staying married to this woman. And therefore, he takes the money, and he says all the time, if the man demands money, and you pay him money to give the get, you have to bribe him to give a get, that's not considered coercion. That's considered that he's making his own free choice, that's free will. Based on that, Rav Moshe wants to suggest that that was a good get. Now, in other situations, he speaks about the fact that if these secular courts are creating fines in order to generate this problem, in order to generate the situation in which the husband owes money, that would be problematic. Because that's not a monetary obligation that's already existing, that pre-exists, or that is rightfully there. They're creating a knas, and that would be problematic. He does say about prenuptial agreements that they will work, because the prenuptial agreements create a monetary obligation before there's any divorce proceedings. And therefore, the monetary obligation can be enforced later on. And then the only choice is the woman will forgive the monetary obligation if he gives the get. So there again, it's not coercion. It's a choice that he's making. The monetary obligation is outstanding. That monetary obligation that's outstanding, he has two ways to discharge it. He can either pay the money or divorce the woman. But then he's making a choice. Which does he like better? He likes the woman better, he likes the money better. And that's a free choice. Rav Nasha Klein spends a lot of time on Rav Moshe and answering Rav Moshe's tshuva. He says in the end that it's true what Rav Moshe says, but he doesn't believe that the secular courts can really enforce mizonot, that they're going to give the right number. And he is very negative on the secular courts interfering in halachic issues. He actually spoke, he writes one of his tshuvot, he wrote a letter, and he was invited by the Supreme Court of New York to speak on the issue when the get law went into effect. And he makes a couple of points to them. First of all, he says it's a country founded on separation of church and state, and the fact that the secular courts are getting involved in gitei nashin is a violation of separation of church and state. That's what he said, first of all. He said, second of all, that the courts have no right to be involved in Torat Moshe. And we don't hold of dina machuta dina when it comes to things that deal with personal liberties or religion. The courts are not allowed to enforce that. When it comes to civil laws, when it comes to laws that deal with the country or the betterment of society, that's fine. But when it comes to individual laws, the civil courts have no rights over a religious Jew. And based on that argument, he wants to say that the get law is extremely problematic, and any get given under get law would be problematic, because it's being coerced are enforced by civil courts who don't have that right in halacha to do that, and that's called a get mu'seh, which is not a valid get. And even based on what he says with the Moshe about the fact that if there's a monetary obligation outstanding, maybe coerce it. He says over there, it's not even so clear to him that that should work that way. He learns the Pitchei Tshuva a little differently than Rav Moshe. And even though he, in the way end, seems to say, okay, maybe Rav Moshe's right over there, he narrows it significantly and thinks even in the cases where there is monetary obligations outstanding, that that's still considered to be coercion. Because if you put a person in a bind where they have no choice, that's considered to be coercion. And here, you're putting him in a bind where the monetary obligations are so high or so much that he has no choice. He can't live. And then he's very negative on the secular courts in terms of their awarding custody always to the mother and the fact that they don't really look into the situations carefully. But if this woman screams that she's an aguna, they automatically put pressure on the husband and he has to pay alimony and all these other things. And that there's never any deference given to the male or the husband. He says that from experience. I'm sure that experience goes both ways, that there are times when it's problematic for the woman, problematic for the husband, but he was very negative on the courts from some of the personal experiences that he had in terms of gittin and the secular courts. But it's a very important issue here in terms of get me'useh. Again, the general principles are that a get can be given as long as, number one, the coercion is not provided by secular courts, only by a beit din. That's number one. Number two is that even the beit din who provides coercion can only buy coercion which is outside the get itself. They can't do it through a situation where they leave the person no choice. It has to be that he's making a choice. We might encourage the choice in a certain direction, or it might be compelling for him, but it still has to be something that he chooses to do. And that's why many times in Israel and other places that they use in terms of the get law is that they remove the rights of the individual. A person who is a misarev and doesn't give a get, for instance, he can't get a driver's license. Otherwise, he can't get a passport. Those are rights or privileges for people in society. We can deny him those rights and privileges, and that's not considered to be a get mi'useh. Because he can stay here, he can stay in Israel, he cannot drive. He has that option. But as long as you're taking away rights and privileges, a person can still exist, and those loss of rights and privileges he can attain by giving the get. But if we do something punitive towards him, we levy fines or we do other things towards him, that would be a problem of a get mi'useh. That's just in summary the sugya of get mi'useh, which is a big sugya, has a lot of writing about it, as well as many court decisions about it, both in the secular and in the religious side. They can't enforce anything directed at the get itself. They're going to enforce things around the get. So what we want them to do is deal with issues that are not directed at the get itself. Nothing to do, ignore the get. Just enforce other things to the point where he reaches a situation where he wants to give the get. That's basically what we want to do. It's a Rabbeinu Tam's suggestion that we can create enough social pressure on the individual. There in the Beit Yosef, he discusses a case from the Teshuvot where they incarcerated the father in order to force the son to give a get. Is that considered to be undue coercion? A lot of the Rishonim want to suggest that that's fine because he didn't do anything to him. The fact that he wants his father back, he wants to free his father, that's fine. That's his own choice. Others say that that's unfair because of Rachmei Av al Banim. There's a unique relationship between a father and a son. So if you incarcerate the son in order to force the father, that's really the equivalent of incarcerating the father, and therefore it's no good. But there are others that suggest that that's not a problem. As long as you don't touch him directly or the get directly, you're fine. That's Rabbeinu Tam's suggestion to create social pressure around him or remove rights from this individual in order to compel him to act in a certain manner. All right, next parak. We'll begin the parak. Shuma Yitomim Shloshim Yom. If for whatever reason Beit Din has to sell the property of Yotomim in order to pay off a Balchov, in order to get Mizonot, they have to, the auction goes on for 30 days. They have to announce that they're selling the field for 30 days. Shum HaHekdesh, if they're selling on behalf of HaHekdesh, Shishim Yom, it's for 60 days. Umachrizim Baboker Be'erev. And they announce the field sale, they have to give notice of it every morning and after evening during that 30-day period or that 60-day period. The Gemara says, Maishnav Baboker Be'erev. What's unique about the fact that you do it in the morning and the evening? So I'm Rav Yehuda Amara, B'shat Otsat Polim, or B'shat Hachnasat Polim. So you would have read this as being Hatsat Polim means when they go out to work, Shat Hachnasat Polim is when they come back from work. Tosafot reads it the other way around and says that Shat Otsat Polim is about when they come home. Shad Achnasat Polim is when they come into work. And therefore, the continuation of the Gemara reads like this. B'shad Otsat Polim, Deika Denecha Lemizban, the time of the Polim going home. A Balabai might want to buy the field. Amalula Polim, he says to the workers, Izilu Sairala Niale, go ahead and check it out. On your way home, check out the field. And this is why Tosafot thinks it's the right way, because if it's on the way to work, why would he ask them to go check out the field on his own time? He needs them to work now. He's not going to ask them to go check out the field. He's asking them on their way home, please check it out. Shagach nasata polim, at the time that the polim come to work, the nidkar, per damalo nezal nishalinu, then he remembers about the field and he'll ask the polim that he sent the previous night to look at the field, what do they think of it? Tami nami ochi, we have a braita that supports that position. Shuma yitomim shloshim yom, shuma yakdei shishim yom. The assessment, beit on beitin, to sell it through auction process, for yitomim, it's 30 days, hekdesh 60 days. Umachrizim ba boker uberev. That's the qualification that we saw. It has to be night and day. Bishat otzat polim, ushat haknasat polim. So why is it boker and erev? For the reason that we brought. Omer, when they do this auction, or when they announce it, steploni b'simanel ubimitzarea kachi. This is the field. This is the borders of the field, the boundaries of the field. Kachi yafa, this is what it produces per year. This is the output of such a field, or the uses or utility of such a field. Kachi shuma, and this is the assessment, which is interesting. If you would have thought they would have gone to a blind auction, even though Beit Din assessed how much it should be worth, they would have gone to a blind auction in order to end up with bidding above the level of Beit Din. But over here it says you have to disclose the amount that Beit Din says. And Tosafot, based on that, says, v'mamalve rutzeh la'akev v'kach shishamu Beit Din eitzarech l'achriz. If the Malve agrees to the price that Beit Din sets, no, you don't have to go through an auction. He can take that property right away and we're done. The whole process is done. You only need the auction if the Baal Chov is unwilling to accept that assessment of Beit Din, and then we have to look to a third party to try to pay the assessment of Beit Din and then give him the money. Kachi Shema, Kol Rotzeli Kachi Abov Yikach. Anybody wants to buy it should show up to buy. Almanat Ten Lisha B'Ktubata. And we explain why we're selling it. We're selling either to pay off the Ktubah of a woman, we're paying off an outstanding loan.
That's a generic thing.
For example, if it's for this reason, we say the reason that we're selling it. So why do we have to say the reason that we're selling it? Why does it make a difference to the buyer? Some people would rather buy from a Baal Chov because he can give coins that are not exact, that are chipped, that are broken, and he'll accept them. They're not so makpid on the coins being exact or perfect. So therefore, he's rather worth the Baal Chov who'll take any type of currency. Some people rather pay off a woman to shakla al yad. She'll take it in installment payments. She doesn't need all the money at once. She doesn't need to pay off right away. She's willing to accept it in installments. And she's willing to accept it in installments. That might be better for him. So there are reasons why a person might favor one of the parties who is the beneficiary of the sale, and therefore we say that in order to encourage those types of buyers to step up and buy the field. Okay, we'll stop over here.